Hi, I'm Dan Sinclair. Welcome to episode 156 of Speaking of Mysteries. Libby Fisher-Hellman joins me to talk about High Crimes, the fifth installment of her series featuring private investigator Georgia Davis. Here's Libby Fisher-Hellman. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm excited to be talking to Libby Fisher-Hellman, whose fifth Georgia Davis crime fiction novel, High Crimes, has just been published. Welcome, Libby.
Thanks, Nancy. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I've been a fangirl for a long time, so, it's really good to talk to you. As I mentioned, High Crimes is your fifth Georgia Davis crime fiction novel. But before we talk about her, before we talk about Georgia and the story in High Crimes, mm-hmm. I want to start this interview at the end of your book with your author's note. I do my best to keep Speaking of Mysteries a politics-free zone for a number of reasons. One, because I have quite a few writers from not in the United States. But 2 years into the current administration here in the States, which is pretty much the gestational period for a book, the administration's influence on writers is going to show up more and more. Mm-hmm. So I want you to talk about the impact the current administration had on your writing and how you channeled the headspace you had entered because of it into creativity.
Okay. Basically, and I make no apology for this, I, like most of the rest of the country, went into a state of shock after he was elected. I couldn't believe it, and that shock turned into rage. And I basically was in a state of semi-paralysis, both mentally and emotionally, for literally a year. I could not write. I could not do anything except hang out online and find people who said they were friends or had sources in the intelligence community who were telling people all sorts of things, most of which turned out to be true, by the way. But I alienated a lot of people, a lot of friends. I think I lost a ton of friends on Facebook, and I just was at my wit's end. I couldn't talk about anything else. People were I think people were really concerned with my mental health, and I'm not exactly sure why it affected me so deeply, but I know that the kind of personality the man has is just an anathema to me. I mean, I just couldn't deal with it, especially after having a presence like Obama, who was so graceful and intelligent and articulate and compassionate. So anyway, I actually did try to write. I outlined two novels, brainstormed two different novels with some friends. And one of them was an historical that went back to the McCarthy period. The other was a contemporary Georgia thriller. And I got to the end of it, and I said, I am not doing these. It's just, when you're a writer, you have to have this little spark in your gut that tells you, this is the book I need to write. And neither of those outlines was giving me that little spark in my gut. And then a year went by, literally, and it was only after, it was in November of last year, so a year ago, that it finally sank in that I had given this man all of my power, or too much power, let's put it that way. And I slowly started to come out of it and decide that, a year of rage was enough, and I was searching for something to write, and about 2 days after the election, this woman that I know had started a Facebook group about possible Trump/Russia conspiracy or collusion. And it had exploded within 3 months to 42,000 people. And her name was Susie Fisher, and she spells it the same way I spell Fisher. So we started to connect, you know, in the beginning, and I wondered if she was a relative, a long-lost relative or something, and she wasn't. But we had, kind of a relationship going, and she was incredibly articulate, probably as angry as I was about the situation. And I was just looking over the post one day or one evening, and it just came to me, and I said, wow, what if I wrote about a Facebook group and the founder of the Facebook group was assassinated? Who would have done it and why? And if it had 42,000 people, does that mean that there would be 42,000 suspects? And I knew from the minute I started thinking about it, I got that little spark in my belly, and I knew that I was going to, that was the book I needed to write. And so, with a lot of help from a couple of friends, I started writing it. And I knew also that I wanted to get it out quickly, because if I had waited for a couple of years, number one, everything would be different, and it is already. From what I, what I wrote, events have changed everything. But I wanted to get it out around the time of the midterms, like a week afterwards. I wanted to give the midterms a little bit of time to sift through, and if the results were great for the Democrats, they would be hopeful, and if they were horrible, everyone would be trying to figure out the next step. And luckily, it turned out that a lot of people were hopeful. So that's basically the backstory of how the book came to me. There were things that I knew that I wanted to do in the book. Number one was I never use his name anywhere in the book. I call him the occupant of the Oval Office and occasionally the president. Number two, I knew I was going to be writing about the polarization and divisiveness in our society, but I wanted to make very clear that neither the left nor the right had any kind of halos coming their way. There are no heroes in this book, except maybe for Georgia, who is the investigator. I mean, both sides are not to blame, but both sides have people in them, people who are doing flawed things. Who are flawed, doing things that are not exactly things that most of us would approve of. So,
both sides have warts.
Pardon me?
Both sides have warts.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I wanted to make that clear so that people wouldn't think that this is a diatribe, against the president or against Republicans or something, because it isn't. It really isn't. I mean, I even think Trump had a good idea once in a while. I'm willing to concede that had he not been the same, had he had a totally different personality, there may have been things I could have agreed with. But it's his personality and that just got to me. So.
In the book, in High Crimes, as you mentioned, Georgia is asked to look into the assassination of a leader of this group, which is called the Resistance. And she's asked by the victim's family. The case has more or less been closed by the authorities because of the suicide of the gunman, or the apparent gunman, because he was now dead. But that sort of closed the case. And here's my question. Was the idea of a political assassination at the core of a story a scary prospect? I heard that Frederick Forsyth once said that writing The Day of the Jackal really scared him, the way he wrote it.
No, didn't. Because I wasn't assassinating, someone in the administration. I was assassinating a normal person. So it was much more to me, it felt much more like a typical kind of crime thriller where Georgia has to put the pieces together, and a really kind of perplexing one, because as you may remember, the reason Georgia is asked to investigate is that an email is sent to the dead girl's mother, a very mysterious, undecipherable email that says something like, things are not what they seem, follow the beef jerky. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And then the email disappears, or the account from which the email was written is not able to be found. That really set things in motion. And between that and the fact that this Facebook group, and I do, Facebook gets a little bloodied in this book. I'm waiting for their lawyers to come to my door, but I don't think they will, because nothing I wrote was inaccurate. Between what's been going on with Facebook and fake accounts and stealing data, other companies stealing data from Facebook, you know, it could very well have been someone who joined that group to kind of monitor and spy on it as, you know, with ulterior motives.
I was going to say, I think that the authorities and everybody involved felt a little bit relieved that the assassin was conveniently dead. Everybody could just move on, including the family of the woman who was killed, except for her mother, as you said, who received this mysterious missive and went to Georgia to look into it.
Right. And so then Georgia sets out on an investigation, her biggest, most complex investigation yet, of the five books. So there she goes. And I did have her, you know, I grew up in Washington, D.C. Probably a lot of your listeners already know that. Or probably, I don't know if they even care, but I've been in Chicago. I've been in Chicago now over 40 years. And I've never set anything in Washington. So in this book, I do send Georgia to Washington to follow up some leads, some possible avenues of investigation. And I had such a good time writing about D.C. I mean, the traffic in D.C. is horrible. I mean, I know Chicago traffic is horrible, and I know L.A. traffic is even worse. But Washington has a special flavor about it. Maybe L.A. has a little of that, too. It's the sense of entitlement, where I'm important, I work for the government, so I can cut you off. And I'm not going to put my blinker on. And I'm going to ride your tail if I think you're going too slowly. And so I used to tell my kids that the only time I would allow them to curse was when they were in traffic. So it was kind of fun to talk about Washington traffic. And then I also had a chase scene, which, of course, I set in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And only people who know what neighborhood I grew up on will understand the landmarks and stuff like that. So I'm curious to see how many people write me and say, I know where it was. So that was kind of fun. And then I also have Georgia go to a Minnesota ice house, to Upper Minnesota. I had never, when I moved to Chicago, had no idea what an ice house was, or that they thrived in northern climates. And I've been inside an ice house, and it's really amazing. So I had a good time.
That was a great touch, I thought.
Thank you.
To send Georgia up to these, you know, the far north.
Right.
To explore.
Right near Canada. Yep.
To explore people that actually sit on ice and stick a fishing pole into a hole in the ice.
Yep. It was fun. And I didn't really have to do all that much research for the book. I had to figure out the untraceable email account. And I had to have a pretty thorough knowledge of pipe bombs and how to put those together. And actually, somebody who reviewed it already said, what, did she have a time machine or something? Because of the pipe bombs, you know, just a few weeks ago in the news. So who knew?
I've often said this, that writers, and it goes back to the first question of, you know, writers have to filter what's out there through their imagination to out their fingers onto the keyboard.
Right.
And it may look like you were prescient, and you were, because you were picking up on things that were being bandied about. Even if someone didn't say to you, oh, you know, so people are going to send pipe bombs. You know, the concept of people sending bombs and the two sides of this equation just going off in at light speed in different directions makes it entirely feasible. So that's what you do. That's what, and especially,
well, that's right. I mean,
fiction,
it has to be credible. Everything I do has to be grounded in something that's credible, that is plausible, and that actually could happen. That's sometimes the toughest part. But in this book, I mean, this book, once I really got going, it really almost wrote itself. I don't know why, but I suppose everything that had been lurking in my mind for the past year was sort of coming out in dribs and drabs.
Writing is therapy.
Yes, it really was a catharsis for me, because I felt a lot better when I finished the book than I had when I started it. And even if, you know, it was only indirectly about the administration, it still got, I was able to get in a lot more of what's been going on in this country than I had imagined. I mean, I even got in Cambridge Analytica and data mining, which is now the biggest, probably one of the biggest industries that never was before 18 months ago. So that was good, too. Oh, and there's a personal component. I completely forgot.
Oh, I'm going to ask you about, you mean George's personal component?
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
But first, I wanted to talk to you about Georgia, who I consider one of the fearless leaders of the group of women private investigators who are neither victims nor femme fatales. You know, she has a good relationship with the man in her life. And, you know, because he's actually a sworn officer of the law, she does have to go to him sometimes for info, but not to save her. She stands on her own two feet. And this is a bit of a genre question. You know, how important do you think this equality of investigative talent is vital to the genre?
I think it is. I think it's important. You know, in a PI book, I do not want Georgia to be saved by anyone. She'll save herself. Thank you very much. Now, if I were writing in my other series, my Ellie Foreman series, I would have Georgia save Ellie, because, you know, Ellie is an amateur sleuth and doesn't really, I mean, she's got her father's old Army Colt 45 at the ready if she needs it, but she's really not a fighter. And Georgia used to be a cop, so prior to becoming a PI. So, in fact, the first time we meet her is in one of my Ellie Foreman books, and she is still a cop. So she knows her way around a gun. She knows her way around a fight. She's not easily spooked by people or stuff. And I believe it is very important for female PIs to be able to hold their own. You know, I started a blog several years ago with six other Chicago crime writers, and it was called The Outfit. And we had a discussion once about the difference between female and male PIs. And really, you could broaden that out to male or female sleuths. And what we came down to is that male sleuths wanted redemption, or, you know, male PIs were always looking for some form of redemption in their lives. whereas females were looking for recognition and respect. And I still think that's the case today. But I write Georgia as someone who can basically take care of herself, you know, or she should be able to. So.
Well, she's good at her job, but she does have a complicated, she has a complicated personal life. And
yeah, she does.
And but this is a little bit more of a I mean, you can certainly talk about the complications in her personal life. But when you're bringing together the foundation for a new story, so we sort of got the genesis for the investigation part of this story of how that came about. You know, but then you have her personal life. I was wondering how much does one, you know, which is the case at hand, and the other, which are the events in her personal life, inform the other? How do you build this foundation for your story with the case and what's going to go on in George's life?
Again, it just naturally flowed together. George's personal life has changed dramatically. Her arc over the past 5 novels has changed dramatically. When we first see her, she has been dumped by her boyfriend, who took up with another woman. She has been unfairly suspended from the police force, or at least it looks like she has been unfairly. She has been unfairly suspended, and she has this personal baggage where her mother walked out on her when she was 12 years old, and never ever got back in touch with her. Didn't call, didn't email, didn't text, didn't do anything. Just vanished. And so Georgia has a lot of rage bottled up inside of her because of this abandonment, as would any young child, I think, or a young woman on the cusp of becoming a woman. And that makes her very distrustful of other people. It keeps her from reaching out to have friends. She's only got one friend in the entire world. She now doesn't even have a boyfriend. She has a mentor who used to be a cop, who is a cop, and he is still her mentor. But that's about it. I mean, Georgia doesn't want to get to know you. She doesn't want to go out to lunch with you. She's not social. She is fairly isolated. And now, in the end of the 5th book, she has a half-sister. Her half-sister has a baby boy. They are living with Georgia. She has a new boyfriend. I made her wait 2.5 books before she before she got a new boyfriend in the 4th book. And then I always knew when I wrote the 5th Georgia book, whatever it was going to be, that it would deal more directly with her mother. I didn't know how it was going to happen or something, but when I got this idea for the Facebook group and the assassination, I knew that her mother was going to play a role in it. And sure enough, her mother shows up fairly early in the book, about 80 pages in, and Georgia cannot handle it. She kicks her out. She kicks her half-sister out. She's like, who the hell do you think you are coming back here after all these years? What, did you think I was going to throw you a party? You know, get out. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Go away. And basically, that's her attitude through most of the book. And at the end of the book, we don't know what's going to happen. There is a little bit of things. I can't tell you. It would be a spoiler for the readers. But she calms down a little bit. But we still don't know whether they're ever going to be able to have a relationship, her and her mother. We don't even know if her mother's going to stay in Chicago. You know, so we'll see.
But I thought the theme of family was kind of overarching. There was the assassin and his relationship with his sister. There was the woman who was assassinated and her relationship with her brother and her mother and her father. I found this sort of idea of relationship among family members to sort of be something that continued through the entire book. And I found that very engaging. It was, it really, it kept me interested in the characters. I was interested in the characters anyway, but you begin to see that people have difficult family lives, no matter what they do, whether they're, work in bars or are wealthy or, have successful businesses or businesses on the ropes, that this is a constant struggle for everybody.
Yeah. That was kind of what I wanted to say. Dina, who is the girl that is killed in the first chapter, had a very kind of close, almost too close relationship with her father. She and her father resemble each other more than the other members of their family. And the father and mother are divorced. The mother has remarried. So there's that tension between the father and the mother, and Dina and the stepfather, and Dina and her father. And then Dina cannot forgive her father for the divorce and blames it on her father while doing some of the same things that her father did. Like I said, it's full of flawed characters. The father is deeply flawed. Dina is flawed. The brother is flawed. The mother I did not get too much into her, because I just couldn't. I didn't have the time or the space to do that. But then we get into the victim, and we talk about the perpetrator, the supposed perpetrator, and his relationship with his sister, and he's certainly a flawed character. And so, yeah. Families are screwed up. Most families are. And it always gives one or more members of a family a status as an outsider. And that's what Dina's brother was. Dina's brother was the outsider. And in a sort of way, the perpetrator's sister was an outsider. And then, of course, Georgia is the consummate outsider, even within her own family. So,
but one of the things that I appreciated was all of these characters have agendas, personal agendas, and certainly Georgia has an agenda in her investigation. There's certain things she wants to do. She wants to earn a living. She wants to prove things to herself. She wants to prove things to the world, as you said. She wants to show, she wants recognition.
Right, exactly.
And her mother has an agenda and her sister has an agenda. And I've often been curious about this and how writers keep these ulterior motives / agendas straight as they weave the story together with all of these characters. Because I think one of the beauties of really good crime fiction, especially with PIs or procedurals with the detective, is the idea of getting inside their heads. Is that personal connection with the reader?
Yeah, for me it's actually pretty easy because each character is so distinct to me while I'm writing that I don't really have a problem understanding what they want. But you're right. Every character has to want something that they cannot have in the moment. And another word for that is conflict. And, of course, that is the basis of fiction, of good fiction, is conflict, whether it's only a glass of water that the character can't have. But if they're working toward a goal and something is keeping them from that goal, that's when you have great conflict. And what I love to do is to put two characters, both of whom have different goals. They may not be conflicting goals, but they just may be different from each other. I like to put them in the same scene and see what they do. And so I was able to do that with some of the characters in this book. And I never quite know how it's going to turn out, but I do know that they are more interesting, and that the book it has a little added depth when I do that.
You like to put them together and see if there's going to be fireworks.
Yes, exactly. Well, see who's going to take advantage of whom, who's going to exploit whom, who's going to walk away thinking, I got that one knocked, and who's going to walk away saying, he better watch out. You know, I mean, who knows? There could be a number of different reactions. The other thing that I like to do, which I do in my historicals, I think you know, I probably write standalone historical thrillers as well, is basically an extension of that, which is I like to put ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances and see what they do. And some people will end up being heroes and brave people and people that actually make a difference in the world. And others will be cowards or villains or worse, or murderers. And sometimes I know which is which, but a lot of times I don't, and I'm surprised when I'm writing a book. Like A Bitter Veil, which is my book about the revolution in Iran, I had no idea. I kept trying out villains for that book, and I kept finding something to like about each person, which crossed them off the list. And I got to the end of the book, and I had no idea how I was going to end it. But it was a fun exercise. I enjoyed doing it.
Well, you know, writers are certainly entitled to fall in love with their characters, and you spend an awful lot of time with them, so there has to be something there that keeps you going back to visit with them.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Yeah, it's not that I'm in love with them. It's just I find them interesting, and I want to test them, and I want to see how far they'll go to get their goal. You know, will somebody go stoop to murder? Will somebody else not? You know, I just like to play with them.
So what are you working on now? Are you working on another Georgia novel or one of your other series or a standalone? And will Georgia be back and all that?
Well, both Georgia and Ellie will probably be back. Although I do have to admit, when I got into that fallow period of a year right after the election, I really, and then I finally started writing High Crimes, I really did think this was going to be my last book, and I wasn't promising anything beyond finishing this book. So then I'm finishing it, and I'm getting ready to get it published, and all of a sudden, an idea comes to me, and it is going to be a standalone historical, and it's going to take place during the Vietnamese War, you know, in the 60s, and I am going to Vietnam in March. So I am probably not going to, I don't think I'm going to finish it in a year. I think it's going to be a little bit more than a year. I'm probably going to ask my agent to see if she can sell it traditionally, you know, because I'm a hybrid. I go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this will be of interest. It's going to be probably two Vietnamese sisters who are young women during the Vietnamese War, and they have very different stories. And that's all I know. I don't even know if it's going to be a mystery or a thriller. That's all I know.
Well,
I haven't even started it.
I think that that's one of the wonderful things about crime fiction. There are many wonderful things about it. One of them is it will take you, for the readers, it will take you places that you might not ordinarily go. And for the writers, you get to do research. I was with Naomi Hirahara over the weekend, and she was inducted into the Romans Walk of Fame. And,
oh, cool.
And I had the distinct honor and pleasure of being her interviewer for the Q&A afterwards. I know. I mean, I'm still floating from that.
That is so cool. I didn't know that.
And
she's so modest.
She's just amazing. Anyway, Her next series is going to be based in Kauai, in Hawaii. And so, of course, I asked if she needed a research assistant.
Right. I did know that. Yeah, yeah. Naomi and I were in a group together for about 3 years. And she's just great. I love her.
And so that's, I think that is one of the marvelous things. You know, we talked, you know, how crime fiction as a story can introduce you, it can take you to different places and it can take you to different times. And it tells an engaging story that keeps you going. And along the way, you're going to get, if the writer is good, like you, like Naomi, you're going to get insight into the time and the place and the people that live there and, you know, see things through their eyes. So I look forward to that that book. I think the Vietnam in the 60s is a fascinating territory to explore.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting.
Libby Fisher-Hellman, thank you so much for talking to us. And
thank you.
Us about high crimes. And once again, you know, I look forward to catching up with you when your next book is published.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Nancy. It's really been a pleasure.